Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. We're here in the second week of October, well into our fall season now, it seems. We've had this stream of these fall storms moving through, bringing stuff in, and I want to take a moment before I go further just to say thanks for joining me this week, and thanks also for sharing your observations. Had reports from several different people over the past couple of weeks that were very interesting to me, and so I appreciated getting those. And if you have anything that you've seen or heard or would just like to share about natural history-wise, feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. Leave a comment there. You can also find links to posts and recordings of past shows, or you can go to sitkanature.org/raven and find a long list of links of all the past shows, as well as you have the opportunity, you could leave a comment there for me. So it's great to have those comments and observations. Like I said, another avenue, if it's strictly birds, and there's several interesting bird sightings over the last couple of weeks, is get on sitkanature.org, and on the main page there, there's a link to the Sitka Birds email list. So you can sign yourself up there or send me an email and I can get you signed up. Just sitkanature@gmail.com and let me know if you're interested in joining the Sitka Birds list. But of the birds that were of interest this past week, perhaps the most exciting was the northern mockingbird that has been hanging around, I guess, kind of between Kagwantan Street and Tlingit Way there. But it's kind of above the grid where people pull their boats up to do bottom work when the tide is out. There's a little dirt road that connects Kagwantan and Catlin Street there in a vacant lot. And just uphill of that vacant lot on Kagwantan, there's a slope and you can see a wooden fence. And on the right side of that fence, there's a mountain ash tree. And the northern mockingbird's been eating the berries out of that mountain ash tree at least at times. So it might be a place that you could actually watch and see if it shows up there if you're interested. It was certainly exciting for me to find out about it. Also got reports of a gear falcon doing a flyby, kind of chasing the gulls out over the channel and then just heading south. And gear falcons have been reported here a few times. They're more northern birds, but a large falcon bird without kind of the distinct face markings of a peregrine falcon. I have not yet seen one, but I would be excited to do so. Another bird that is more typical for here, but still considered rare in the state, is the American coot. And American coots usually start showing up around this time of year. Got the first report just this week of one in Crescent Harbor. I've been watching Swan Lake, which is where they often will show up, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 of them in a given year, seem to show up there between October and November. And they'll typically stay on the lake until it freezes, after which they'll move down to saltwater. In the last 2 or 3 years, at least, there's been one or two that have wintered there, kind of along the between A and B Harbor and the Murray Pacific building there, the Fisherman Key, just along the shoreline and under the piers there, and they seem to find enough to eat over the course of the winter, and then in the springtime they leave. So it's always kind of fun to welcome those ones back again. Also of interest for Sitka is the sanderling that was at Totem Park. It was hanging out, very distinct, smaller, very pale-looking bird relative to the black turnstones it was hanging out with when I saw it. I think they're probably not that unusual this time of year, and maybe even throughout the winter on the outside where they like the sandy beaches. And so maybe over on Cruise Off, it wouldn't be that hard to see them. But here in town, we don't really get them that often in the fall or spring, for that matter. So that was kind of fun to see. And then also our stormy weather, which is, you know, I guess kind of fallen into the fall pattern here of blustery days and rain and rain showers, sometimes heavy, interspersed with some nicer weather between fronts. But that often brings in the storm petrels this time of year. And there have been storm petrels, fork-tailed storm petrels in particular, reported out in Crescent Bay in that area, and even got one report of one flying across the flats at Totem Park at dusk. So it's a good time to watch out for those. Also got a report of a least storm petrel under the lights at Moeller Park one evening when the lights were there. Unfortunately, I'd been there, but just missed it by a few minutes. And I still have yet to see one of those out in the wild that hadn't been captured or wasn't already deceased for some reason. So yeah, those are some of the interesting bird reports that I've had. Actually, one that we just got this weekend was cedar waxwings. There's still apparently a few of those around, and also a report of a bohemian waxwing. They're you know, both those birds are, they're similar looking, but very sort of, very striking in appearance. They have kind of interesting colors, and they have very fine feathering, so that makes them look very smooth. It's hard to see the individual feathers. And so keep your eyes open for those. Often at this time of year, you'll be most likely to find them in some of those fruit-bearing shrubs and trees that have berries on them that persist into the cold season. And speaking of which, it has started to finally cool off, at least sometimes. We've still had temperatures and forecasts with highs in the upper 50s, but there has been some cooler temperatures. And on a couple of our nicer days over the last couple of weeks, I noticed the first snows on the mountains, and of course then followed up by warmer temperatures, and it melts off. But it's always kind of exciting to see that first clean white snow on those mountains. And I guess there's just something about those first layers of snow that come down and really bring out the contrast in the rocks and the textures of those high rocky peaks. And so it's a good time of year to just keep your eyes out looking up at the mountains and just appreciating the beauty that's around us and so easy to take for granted sometimes. So that was exciting for me this week, or in the last week or so as well. Before I get to this week's conversation, I also wanted to mention that I got back out to Stargaven and looked at the landslide again a couple more times after sort of that first initial one. And it'll be interesting to see over the course of the year as heavy rains kind of start washing some stuff out and just to see how it changes. And I'd be very interested in talking to a soils person or a hydrologist, or I don't know who actually studies those sorts of events, but I have a lot of questions about it. It's a lot of things that's sort of very interesting about those sort of events in general, as well as that one in particular, and just trying to understand what happened there. But I should probably go ahead and turn to the conversation for this week. I invited Taylor White to come in and speak with me, and we recorded this conversation a couple of days ago. Taylor is the manager of the aquarium at the Sitka Sound Science Center, and originally I just wanted to talk to her about her activities, you know, in diving and just running the aquarium and all the interesting stuff there. But as it turns out, in the last couple of weeks, sea star wasting disease is showing up in force around Sitka. And so we started out by talking a little bit about that. I guess I first heard about it a couple of years ago, mostly down from the lower 48. And people were saying, we got to watch for it and monitor it up here. And you know, it was mostly just kind of this background level, occasional sea stars with little evidence of looking similar, but I guess they don't know if it was really the same thing or something. And then this, was it about, like I say, 3 weeks ago or so, somebody noticed in the harbor that it was coming on strong.
Yeah, so Patty Dick actually called a bunch of people, because a bunch of people are involved in this, and I'm definitely, like, you sound about as expert as I am on this disease, because nobody knows what's causing it.
Yeah.
And it's just been quite a mystery. Patty Dick called it in to Marnie Chapman at UAS and Ashley Bulwark at the Sitka Sound Science Center, who actually talked to me about it, because I've been doing these long-term monitoring plots at the Science Center. And so is Ashley, and a few other people are involved. Marnie's involved in that as well. And looking just at baseline populations and not looking for sea star wasting per se, just these long-term plots. And
so these plots, just as an aside here, the plots are, some of them are, go back to Ed Ricketts and Jack Calvin from the 30s, maybe?
Is that when they were up here? 1932 is when they were surveying some of these sites, and it was a bit of a scavenger hunt to find them.
Yeah.
It was fun, and there's like, we were looking at photos and matching up just basic descriptions, no Latin longs, like Kayak Island was spelled incorrectly, but we were like, oh, what's the only island called Kayak? So pretty sure they did a survey on that shore. And then with their sort of qualitative analysis of the beach, we're like, yeah, that sounds kind of
accurate. I guess I don't know. I mean, because they would have been here before the big buildup to World War II, so I don't know how much might have changed. Like, Kayak has an emplacement, but it would have presumably been above tide line.
Yeah.
But anything over on Japonski Island in that area probably is just like, it's gone now, I would
imagine.
Or
even Jamestown Bay.
Oh.
That was it wouldn't have worked out for our sites, because they're rocky intertidal sites, and it's impossible to kind of set up long-term. It's not impossible. It's really hard to set up long-term monitoring sites in mud flats for what we're looking at. I guess I wouldn't say it's impossible at all. But they, they were just going around and looking at these mud flats in Jamestown Bay, which just aren't there anymore because of all the fill.
Yeah.
And so they just apparently used to be these just spanning mud flats, and it just sounded really cool in the descriptions.
I think
diving there, you see it still. But.
Well, and you see the, you know, you see some of the old photos, but like it's essentially, I think, from Castle Hill, or, you know, maybe a little towards the park from Castle Hill, but Crescent Bay used to have all the flats there, which is now Crescent Harbor. And then just by the Science Center, this flat start, and you could still see the remains of the flats kind of underneath the breakwater at low tides in that one corner. And then it goes around the park. And I've seen pictures that show, like, going across over to, there's the little Cannon Island, and it seems like there's actually a couple islands there, and it's a little causeway where it's just built up a little bit above the flats. And then on the other side, you're into kind of a more industrial area, National Guard and Isle Marine. And I think that was all like part of that tide flats. I'm not sure quite where it ended over there, but yeah, it's a little bit more reclamation of the intertidal, I guess, there, tide zone stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just was diving Jamestown Bay for the Sea Star Wasting. Mm-hmm. And just, yeah, it was clearly a mud flat.
Like, right. Underneath.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So this Sea Star Wasting, Patty Dick noticed it in the harbor. Mm-hmm. And then so you guys went out and started looking around other places and have found it like several other places since then, or?
Yeah. So I was kind of just shocked because I was like, no way. Is there already Sea Star Wasting disease here? I really had hoped we'd kind of missed a bullet on that one because it hadn't really taken off here yet. And in terms of a wasting event, people have seen little patches of lesions in 2013. Pete, Ramundi, Melissa, and I at Kayak Island saw just a handful of piezasters, those orange and purple stars with lesions, but very few lesions. And they, you know, starfish get stressed and sometimes they contort themselves and they might get a lesion. It could have been other things.
Yeah.
So we were just like, to look at in the future, but not necessarily a giant wasting disease. So I had been diving the Sunday before Patty Dick called all of us, and I had seen just so many healthy sea stars, and I look for these things still because I'd been hearing about it since it started in June of 2013, and was amazed when I went down to Thompson Harbor and walked just the ramp onto the docks, and there were at least 8 dead Pycnopodia. Just they look vaporized, like, and you were saying, they just melt.
The big sunflower stars.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I went to Sealing Cove. Marnie Chapman saw me at UAS, I guess probably it was Tuesday, and she's like, she flagged me down, you know, ran me down while I was on my way to class, and was like, sea star wasting is here and it's really bad. And and she says, you should maybe go over to Sealing because I think they'll already all be gone in Thompson. Once they go, they don't last very long. And so I went over to Sealing, I guess, the next morning, and I saw some of the leather stars that, you know, they looked fine, more or less. And I mean, it wasn't a very low tide, so I wasn't quite sure, but and definitely at high tide, their clarity of the water was too low to actually see from the ramp. But then so that was Tuesday, I went at high tide, and Wednesday I went at low tide, and I could see. And at first I just thought they were kind of bare rocks under, and then I was like, why is there a bare rock there? There wouldn't be any reason for there to be a large, new, fresh rock in there, because it's kind of like this grayish, purplish through the through the stuff. And then it occurred to me that, you know, I think those aren't rocks. I think that's just sort of the goo of the sunflower star that's just hasn't washed away yet, but they are not, you know, not functional anymore. Because there was kind of this vague starfish
shape, and you get this kind of white and then this black sort of anaerobic decay of just.
Yeah, I don't think it had kind of got into that yet. It was just like, it just looked like a pile of. And of course, I couldn't see very well. It was several feet of water that wasn't super clear, but I'm pretty sure that that's what those were. And I haven't gone back and looked to see if I could still see them, but it didn't look like there was a lot left to like persist. Like, once any sort of water flow moves through, it's just going to kind of disappear pretty quickly. And so, yeah, it was a little surprising. It seems like at least those, but those are fairly soft-bodied ones, and maybe was the same thing happened with the harder-bodied ones?
Yeah, so they're finding that it hits Pycnopodia basically first, those sunflower stars, and maybe they are more vulnerable because they're soft-bodied, and it hits sort of the piezasters last, and there's sort of a cascade it goes through. The general order is kind of patchy depending on where you're at.
Yeah.
For just the aquarium, just at looking at our touch tanks, within a week, as of what was it, last Thursday, We've lost all our Pycnopodia. Those are all gone in our touch tanks. And then it kind of hit the rainbow stars. So if you've seen those are more subtitle, and they kind of are patchy light pink and dark pink, and they're beautiful. And then it hit sort of the Brevispinus, these giant pink stars, which are also subtidal. Mm-hmm. And generally it's been hitting subtidally before it moves intertidally. So usually once you see it intertidally,
it's already hit the subtitle stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And so a lot of places, like in Bellingham, they've been diving a lot to try and mm-hmm. to try and find the root cause of it. And so that's probably why Patty found it in the harbor first and not on the shore.
Because you could see down.
Yeah.
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 And low tide.
That's, yeah. And those sort of opportunities are helpful, harbors and things like
right.
that to see.
Yeah.
Because getting diving here is not any any easy thing. But yeah, so after that, we have some okra stars now that are kind of lesion-y and losing their limbs, and that's kind of what happens, is their limbs kind of just crawl away from their body, and you're just left with this sort of central disc, or they'll sort of get lesions and their internal organs will kind of pop out, as it were,
just
kind
of like
gross. Yeah, and at that point, there's so much bacteria in the water, they're just kind of broken down.
Yeah,
and
they have no defenses from everything else.
Right, but what the initial insult that causes that is just a mystery, and that's what's so intriguing about this disease. Is just or syndrome, whatever it is. It could be temperature. It could be some pathogen. We don't know.
So I saw, maybe it was in the press release, or maybe it was a different news release that came out within the last week or so, that there was some thought that colder temperatures maybe provided some protective benefit. Places in the lower 48, in Puget Sound, that it showed up much later, tended to be colder places, and it hadn't showed up here, and it's colder. And I guess it still hasn't showed up in Juneau, which has colder water, but... so maybe, and this year it's been warm.
It's been really warm.
In
oh,
the
man.
Water.
Swimming has been great. It's been like 59 degrees surface temperature.
Is it still that warm out in the
it's
ocean?
Not.
Is
no,
it cooling
it's,
off now?
It's definitely cooled off a bit. So that was kind of strange because it had been slowly cooling through mm-hmm. September, and it hit in the last week of September. And we did these surveys with Pete and Melissa the first week of or the second week, September 8th through the 9th
mm-hmm.
or 10th. And just, it was just 2 weeks later that
2 weeks
was,
later that it showed up. Mm-hmm. And so between the time that it was reported at Thompson Harbor and it showed up in the aquarium was like 2 days, 3 days.
It was a week
or a week before it first showed mm-hmm. up.
But that weekend I went out with Lynn Wilbur mm-hmm. and we dove Jamestown Bay, and just to kind of get an idea of other, mm-hmm. other areas and other substrates and things. And yeah, almost all of the Pycnopodia that we saw were not looking so hot. A lot of decayed ones, a lot of just arms randomly mm-hmm. around the place. Other sea stars like Dermisterius, those leather stars, were looking okay.
Yeah.
And I think a similar thing was reported by Joel and Reed, although they're doing some subtitle surveys as well. Mm-hmm. And they're from UAS. So
those, the fisheries folks there at UAS.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's so then it took a week and it showed up, and of course, I guess your sea stars aren't like in direct contact with any sea stars in the water, but your water is coming through, and
yeah,
so presumably
important.
Whatever it is connected somehow in the water. I mean, like there's something in the water, I guess.
Right, like when the sea stars are spawning out mm-hmm. In the ocean, our sea stars in our tanks are spawning. Whatever is kicking that off is sort of the same thing with any sort of pathogen or temperature change. It's our water's being pulled from 65 feet just right out in front of the science center.
So fairly deep.
Yeah.
But,
mm-hmm.
but so it's interesting. I mean, it's easy to, I guess, imagine some sort of scenario where you could somehow filter the water and just see, you know, is there some sort of thing that's at least big enough to come out in a filter that's causing it, and so in your isolated tank, that of course now it's a little late for that because everything's already been exposed presumably. But
yeah, that would be an interesting question to explore, and a lot of people have explored sort of whether or not it's food, like things like mussels that are accumulating some sort of horrible toxin, and then the starfish eat it, and or what? Yeah. Basically, there are just a bunch of theories right now that are being researched.
And so, how widespread? I mean, it sounds like you guys have looked a little bit around, presumably close to town in Sitka, and is it pretty much everywhere you've looked so far? Or?
Yeah, but we haven't really explored all our areas yet, and we want to, but we really want to hit our long-term monitoring sites first, because just looking at sites and saying it's there is good. It's also good to look for sites and find out that it's not there.
Right. Yes, that would be good.
That's excellent as well. And we're reporting these all to seastarwasting.org, which is a great website, kind of spatially orients where sea star wasting events are happening and where they aren't. And it's run by the same people we do these long-term monitoring sites with. Where was I going with that?
Oh, so where you've been looking so far, just a handful of places. And I guess it's kind of the stormy season, so getting out to Kayak Island's a little less convenient, perhaps, at times. But so far, basically, like maybe a handful of places around town just that are relatively easy to access, they've all shown. It's all been showing up across all of those places anyway.
Yeah, generally. And hopefully we'll start to see it. Well, no, not hopefully at all, but it'll be a lot easier to see it intertidally.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the starfish actually tend to migrate subtidal as it gets colder. So we might not see it intertidally, but getting more dive surveys would be great. But again, with those long-term monitoring plots, it's really cool because we have sort of a baseline of what was normal in these various plots since 2011. So not that far back, but far enough back where, I mean, sea star wasting disease wasn't really an issue. So it's cool because you can compare it to what is healthy, and then maybe hopefully have recruits, little baby starfish populate those plots later, and you can kind of see the change that there. But with maybe subtidal transects or just timed searches of beaches that we're doing now and people are doing now, like Marnie and Reed and Joel and Lynn and all these people are involved in this. Those are really great, but they're really hard to track any change because you don't know the baseline of what was baseline. Normal.
It
would be cool to kind of check out what repopulates the sites and how long that takes, at least.
So it's, I mean, if anybody happens to be out there, then it's and noticing it or noticing a big bunch of healthy looking sea stars, either bit of information is maybe of interest at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. And seastarwasting.org has a really easy form you just fill out and then they'll put it on their map. And if you want to contact me at the Science Center, you can do that too, and I can do that form for you. And we're trying to keep the public updated with a blog at the Science Center on that.
Yeah, I've been the Science Center has the general web blog that they do, and I've noticed that you guys have posted about sea star wasting at least once with some, you know, just the general information about what's going on. And it'll be interesting to see. I mean, obviously it's exciting, but not necessarily in the good way. activities and with the changing of season and the cooling of temperatures. And, you know, the migration of starfish down into deeper water, if they're alive even at all, I guess, at this point. And it'll be interesting to see because they're definitely, you know, ecologically one of those kind of keystone species that they eat a lot of stuff.
Yeah, promote biodiversity in these sites that, you know, we like to see.
So it's going to, you know, maybe in some of these places we'll see the mussel explosion or something like that.
Go crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll see. Yeah, it's a very big experiment.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So it'd be interesting. And so I guess the long-term plots would be interesting to keep track of. And even if, you know, for folks that are just out there and for their own interest, it seems like you just, you know, if you've been visiting a beach for a while, you have a sense. You don't have necessarily any quantitative data, but you can sort of just pay attention and say, well, I wonder what's happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the big long picture, I guess, maybe this is something that happens every couple hundred years or so. We just don't even really know where it's coming from.
And I should say there have been wasting disease
events
in the past. There were found causes of those, and they've done they've done things like affect multiple echinoderms, so things like sea cucumbers, urchins, and sea stars. And but those were sort of pocket wasting events, and not, this is sort of the largest range of of wasting events,
and all up and down the west, basically from it seemed like when I looked at the map on seastarwasting.org, there was at least a couple of reports, maybe from Cook Inlet area. Maybe it was the aquarium up there at Seward. I don't remember.
Yeah, Kachemak Bay.
Was that where it was?
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah, some there were, but a little bit up north of here even, but and then all the way down to California.
Into Baja.
Into Mexico. So, yeah, it's pretty widespread. And I guess part of what's fascinating about it is it's just still a mystery as to what's causing it. And I don't know. Maybe there's not a huge amount of research budget for sea stars, given they're not especially considered commercially important. But
people are making a point to find out. Yeah, and people at Cornell University, there's a lot of pathogen studying going on there. And we've sent some tissue samples to them. Or Melissa Miner sent some tissue samples to them. And we'll see. Although it is kind of hard when you're in a site collecting tissue samples that have probably all been exposed to just so much. There's so much bacteria. It's just, it's, I don't know how they pinpoint that down. I am not obviously a pathologist, but
yeah, it seems like
really,
it would be
really hard.
Yeah, it would be a challenge just because there is so much else going on in the water. And I guess that's also true in the air, but you know, your system seems like they have much more sort of stuff moving in and out of them all the time, you know, via the water, whereas I guess we breathe, but the rest of our body seems to be fairly isolated from the rest of the surrounding areas. So yeah, but on to happier topics.
Yes.
When I was originally going to invite you on, I thought you'd been telling me about some of your diving adventures, and you've been, I don't know, were you scuba diving before this year, or, and you just really ramped up your dive schedule this year? Or?
Yeah, I did. Well, I actually got certified in 2006.
Oh, okay.
So a long time ago.
It's been a couple years.
Yeah, it's been a few years. And then I joined the dive team here with the Sitka Fire Department dive team, and I've been able to get a lot more diving experience with them. And then I have been diving also with ADF&G, doing a little bit of abalone recon and trying to figure out where abalone are in Sitka, and kind of working on maybe surveying those. And just going on fun dives too. Went to St. Lazaria with the dive team. Just great opportunities. It's an unfortunate thing that it's just not that convenient to go diving here. We don't have a dive shop, and gear, if you're on a budget like me, is not that easy to come by, but there are a lot of really great people who are willing to lend.
Yeah.
And so that's so what I've been figuring out.
The Lazaria dive, I guess I've heard of people diving there before, and I guess I heard a little bit about it from you earlier this summer as well, but Lazaria is rich, I guess maybe it's a good way to put it. It's, you know, just sticks up out of the water, and it's very steep. In fact, actually undercut
walls,
in places.
Yeah. And caves.
And with all the nutrients from the birds, presumably.
Probably.
I don't know how much that impacts the, it certainly makes the vegetation very lush above the surface, but I don't know how much it impacts the, you know, the marine organisms below. But presumably there's some upwelling stuff going on there too, as well, just because it just sticks out there. But it's just kind of this wall, I suppose, makes it interesting to dive on. And I guess it's a little bit of a like technical dive to do that. There's even an underwater tube or something that comes up in the middle.
I didn't do that, but
seems like I've heard that's an adventurous dive for folks that are kind of into technical diving, but,
You definitely have to know what you're doing. On that one.
But just even the sort of the wall diving there of colors, and actually was on a tour this summer with a guy that was from California, and he had gone on and worked in other things, but his university background was marine ecology, and so he was very interested. He'd retired, and he was very interested in seeing the stuff there, and it was happened to be a low tide, and I was like, well, St. Lazaria, you'll be able to see at least some of the stuff on the walls. And talking to him, he said, you know, it's like what it used to be like in California, but like sea star wasting had already hit there. And I think there was some other stuff. He said there's just a lot of stuff is gone that used to be there. And he I think he was in Northern California, or maybe he was Southern. I don't know, somewhere in California. So it was interesting to hear him just talk about what you could see from the boat intertidally, and then to find out that there's, well, no doubt a bunch of stuff below the surface as well.
Yeah.
What are some of the exciting things that you get to see on a dive like that?
Oh, man. Just, well, great kelp forests around some of the corners. But we were kind of on the north side and in just going into a cave a little bit. And there are amazing bryozoans, all of these sort of pinks and oranges and sort of colonial bryozoans. And, oh, man, grunt sculpin. I have to talk about the grunt sculpin. Actually, Troy Tedinko picked up three of them and gave one of them to the aquarium. And then he had two in Baranoff Aquarium. And they are the cutest fish alive, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I really like spiny lump suckers. They're adorable, too. But grunt sculpin are hilarious. They kind of like have a zebra-like striping pattern. And then they have a bright orange tail and really beautiful black dots on their dorsal fins. And just kind of a funny squat shape with a almost a seahorse-like tube nose.
Well, and they're small, really small, right? They're like couple three inches
yeah,
long.
Yeah, they easily fit in the palm of your hand. Yeah.
And so you have one at the aquarium now?
Yeah.
So if people want to see one, does it have a name?
It doesn't actually have a name.
It doesn't have a name. The grunt sculpin?
The grunt sculpin.
And what's the name grunt sculpin? Where's that come from?
It comes from a noise it makes, actually. So when it's out of water, it kind of shuffles along with its pectoral fins, and it makes a grunting noise when it does that. So it's all upset, and it just kind of does that.
So when you if you find one, is that something that you could find intertidally, or are they pretty much, I mean, in a tide pool, or are they pretty much subtidal?
I've never found them intertidally. I really wish I could find them easier. They kind of like to hide in these giant barnacle shells.
Oh,
so there's a kind of a strange occurrence at Losaria. There's just a bunch of dead giant barnacles out there. And so they just find sort of safe haven in these little barnacle shells and kind of a little cave for them to hide out in until they need
there.
To eat something like an isopod or an amphipod or whatever small worm they can find.
So when you have it in the aquarium, you have to... I'm like, are you feeding it specifically, or are you just dropping stuff into the water and hoping that it finds something palatable for it?
Yeah, it hasn't quite taken a liking to salmon yet, which is what I tend to feed the aquarium.
Yeah.
But amphipods, so any of the sand fleas that you find on the beach. And I need to figure something else out. I think maybe krill or something, or to maybe culture sea monkeys, because those usually are really popular with the little crustacean eaters like gunnels and
sea monkeys are the thing that little kids buy, right?
Yeah.
But they're basically brine shrimp, is that what they are?
Exactly.
Okay. All right. And do they actually grow in the water, in the ocean, or are, you know, a brine shrimp I tend to think of as these landlocked lakes that are salt lakes, like Great Salt Lake or something in Utah, most famous of them in North America probably, but and then they can actually dry up and blow around in the wind and then land in the water again and reconstitute.
See, I don't know about French.
Well, so that's
amazing.
So that's probably, because I think they sell them as dry things, right?
Yeah,
the sea monkeys.
And so then you hydrate them and they kind of hatch or something.
So they're used to these kind of brine areas that dry up and then they can be blown to a new area and reconstitute. So it's interesting. But then, so they're just another crustacean, I guess. And so they make good food.
Great food
for the crustacean eaters. I never thought about that. But sea monkeys you can probably buy pretty easily.
Yeah, and they're fun to keep, right?
Yeah. Well, I've never actually tried to grow them. I don't know.
It's like, been a while for me.
I didn't get the comic books. I didn't read a lot of comic books, but my memory of sea monkey is some sort of like little ad in the back of a comic book. And it looked like they were growing castles or something.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that it was much less exciting than that in some respects.
Yeah, it's definitely kind of a letdown from those comic book drawings.
But
that's
kind
of what I would feed this guy. When the amphipods and the sand fleas are kind of dwindling, because they do that in the winter, they kind of, that was something I figured out working in the aquarium.
Right.
Was like, oh, sand fleas are kind of
harder to come by,
yeah. And so I started looking for isopods, which are those funny looking bugs that really, I'm not a huge fan of any. They're kind of like the pill bugs of the ocean, and they kind of clasp onto things like kelp, and
it's
they eat kelp.
I'm curious if you said the same, sort of acquired the same local wisdom, which I believe to be incorrect at this point. But when I was a kid, we always called those bloodsuckers. Oh. And I don't know why, but the isopods that you'd find on the rocks and stuff, they're like, oh, there's a bloodsucker. And I'm like,
I've never heard them called that, but that just makes them even more scary to me. But they don't think they suck blood.
No, I don't think so either. And so I'm not sure why. Maybe there's some related species that does somewhere in the tropics or something, because you never know in the tropics. But yeah, that was just when I was a kid. That's what I was told by other kids, of course, that's what they were.
Yeah.
So we tried to avoid, you know, having them crawl on us and stuff.
I think I just avoided it because it was kind of
some of them are a couple inches long.
Yeah,
you know, there
was a big
place by Point Brown, kind of just around the corner from Brent's Beach, and I was walking along there, and I kind of crawled. There's little nooks and stuff in the lava walls, and I crawled back there, and I kind of, like, there was something that moved just above me, and I looked up, and it was like one of those big 3-inch isopods right there above my face. I was like, okay, I'll back out.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like it was going to do anything to me, but you know, it's just one of those creepy crawly things, you
just
know, right by your face.
Kind of a visceral sense of like, oh, this is not okay.
So,
I'm okay feeding those.
Yeah. Oh, so you don't have a sentimental attachment to them. So
more to the grunt sculpin.
The grunt sculpin. So then actually that grunt sculpin is smaller than some of those isopods would be.
So I have to feed it really small ones.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're out there actually. So you just go down to the beach right next to the science center and collect. Do you have how do you collect the beach fleas? You just get.
It's really easy. It's not glamorous at all. In fact, I've had a lot of volunteers do this for me. But basically what you do is just grab a kitty litter or scoop and scoop up some of the gnarly decaying seaweed love and put it in a bucket and put the bucket over the tank and they just hop in on their own accord.
Oh, into the tank.
Into the tank. Yeah. And little do they know, their hungry mouths waiting. And it's interesting to watch, but it is kind of also just like, oh.
Circle of life, I guess. Yes. And so you actually can, when they get into the water, I mean, presumably they can swim, but...
Yeah, they do kind of swim, and they can hide really well and kind of create their own populations in there, which I've tried to do, but since there are so many predators in there, it's hard to keep them up.
Yeah, so your aquariums are a little high on the predator balance side of things.
Definitely.
I guess. Maintained that way by continual feeding.
Exactly. So
not quite, you want to keep those guys happy, I guess. And what other sorts of, is there some sort of, presumably some species that are relatively commonly kept, there's actual information for keeping them. But in general, you're just kind of on your own figuring it out and talking to other people that are, you know.
Yeah, I was actually surprised to learn just kind of how trial and error a lot of aquarium husbandry is. And not that there isn't a lot written about it, but just from people like Andy Case from Tenji came up and he's helped build aquariums in Monterey Bay and in Japan, these really big, nice aquariums. And he was kind of like my mentor and it was really great talking to him and just his trial and error in things like making wave makers or just basically what not to put in tanks together.
Right. Yeah.
You really learn a lot. And, but you try, obviously, you try and research that first so that you don't make the same mistake someone else did.
If you joined us late, welcome. This is Matt on the Sitka Nature Show. And this week's show is featuring a conversation that I recorded with Taylor White a couple of days ago. She is the manager of the aquarium at the Sitka Sound Science Center. And she came in to speak with me a little bit about some of her experiences there and a little bit about sea star wasting, which we spoke of at the beginning of the show. She was a guest last year after her first summer as manager of the aquarium, and so I thought it'd be fun to find out some of the things that she's learned over the last year of trying to keep all of these animals happy and alive in the aquarium there. And so we're going to go ahead and pick up the conversation with her sharing a little bit about what she's learned about some nudibranchs.
There are these really beautiful nudibranchs, these hooded nudibranchs.
Yeah.
And I put them in multiple times and I just thought they didn't have a long lifespan. And I had actually read they actually kind of have a longer lifespan than what they've been living in the aquarium. And so I found out that actually if you touch them, they kind of something inside them explodes and they can't quite handle it in their serrata, these little sort of appendages of sorts, I guess, off of them, off of their body, fall off. And I was wondering why this was happening when I was putting them into the tanks, and they smell crazy, like watermelon. It's amazing. You should, if you ever find one.
If I find one, pick it up
and
smell it.
And it'll explode. But
it'll smell like watermelon.
It'll smell like watermelon.
That's very interesting. And they're pretty common around here.
They are really common around here. But they live a lot longer than I had expected. And without touching them this time, I've been able to keep them successfully for multiple months. So
that's huge. So it's actually the physical. It's not the jostling. It's the actual touch.
It's actually some sort of chemical response that their body.
Can you
has.
Wear gloves or?
I did wear gloves.
And then that works.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, interesting. So it's just really the skin.
Yeah.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
They know that you're a predator or some sort, and they do. They just start to like lose their serrata. So, I think the goal of that is just that whatever predator would eat that.
Yeah,
serrata.
Sort of like the tail dropping or mm-hmm. whatever strategies that various things use. So do they smell like watermelon generally, or only when you touch them?
Well, it's really hard to tell because they're in the water all the time.
Yeah.
And I have tried to smell them when they're close to the surface of the water without touching them, and I haven't smelled anything. So that's about the best research that I can do.
All right. Well, if I see them, I will maybe fish one out with a net or something.
And usually if you see them in the harbor or something, and sometimes you'll see them floating, they're kind of on their way out anyway.
Oh,
so
okay.
If you do fish one out there, it probably wasn't going to survive very long anyway.
All right. So we won't have to feel bad about those ones. But
seriously, they smell crazy.
They smell
and,
like
and
watermelons.
I think many people have thought I'm crazy for saying this, but I'm like, but then I have them smell one, and it's quite impressive.
So,
and it stays on your hands for a long time.
That's probably not something you would have ever guessed that you would learn
right,
in your
these
job.
These random things that you just,
Well, and it's kind of fascinating, you know? There's a ton of stuff that we don't know, and of course, working in the aquarium, you get a chance to work rather closely with a lot of different things. I mean, I imagine. So, have you made any discoveries of bad mixes of species in tanks, or accidentally, or have you managed to avoid that?
I feel like just because I've been there, but I volunteered like over 7 mm-hmm. years ago, and working with Lynn, and there's been very few. We had a crinoid, mm-hmm. Which are these sort of really amazing sort of archaic starfish almost, but they
are they the sea
quite.
Fans
they're not sea no. fans they have multiple hoop limbs, and they basically collect plankton and detritus mm-hmm. in in these sort of tentacles, and they have like this slime that brings it all to the center, and they're cool. They swim, and they have this sort of foot structure too that holds onto things. And I did not know where to put that because they're really fragile, and you really need a good aquarium that with little disruption.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no ideas because all of my aquarium, like all the aquariums where people aren't touching, have fish in them or some other sort of disturbance. And I was like, well, I'll just put it in with the octopus and see what happens. And it's made it, and the octopus was really afraid of it, honestly,
oh, really?
For a really long time. It took a long time for them to become friends, and really, the octopus did take a bite out of it the second it was put in there, and I thought it was the end, but they made friends. And
so the octopus initially decided food,
yes.
Then decided not a good thing.
Not good, no.
Yeah, and so presumably there was some defense mechanism in this crinoid that allowed it to, resist the overtures of the octopus initially.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
that's really interesting. So, and so the octopus there, they don't live that long, right? I mean, how long do they live?
Yeah, around 8 years.
Oh, so a little while. How long is the one that you guys have started out fairly small? Yeah,
she's about 3 years old now,
and she's getting bigger.
Yeah, she's getting bigger, but honestly, not all that much bigger. So, but at around 8 years, and that's kind of, I guess they mature around like 3 to 5 years,
mm-hmm. and then once they lay eggs and stuff, then that's mm-hmm. kind of the end.
That's
whenever
the
that,
end for them, yeah.
Whenever that happens, so is she going to need a bigger tank at some point, or is
probably yes?
So I guess that'll be another
some future planning. But now that all the scaffolding has come down and the aquarium, we've got a lot more space and just a lot of ideas brewing, and that's definitely one of them. Yeah, I imagine a jellyfish tank, which I'm very interested in as well.
That'd be exciting. So, yeah, I guess that is other big news there at the Science Center is that I've been seeing pictures, and I guess I drove by there the other day. But, yeah, it's been unwrapped, the fall...
unveiling.
Fall present, I guess. It's not really a Christmas present, but unwrapped
Alaska
present.
Alaska Day present.
Alaska Day present, there we go. And a much nicer looking exterior, and the windows look a little more draft proof than they probably used to be.
So much more draft proof.
so it'd be nice to see all that work happening there. The octopus, it seems like did you provide it the opportunity to learn how to open a jar?
So that was some of our docents this summer. We had junior mm-hmm. docents. So those are younger volunteers that actually take sort of a base lesson before they come into the Science Center in the summer. And so they learn the basics of just like what aquarium husbandry is and what the various phyla are mm-hmm. and that we focus on in the aquarium. And they were supposed to have their own project. And one of the projects that was to get the octopus to open a jar. And between them and the summer staff, it worked. They started just feeding the octopus with the crabs in the jar that just mm-hmm. alone, the jar alone. And then they kind of slowly eased the lid onto it without really screwing it on at all. Mm-hmm. And then slightly screwed it on and she's figured it out. She took a really long time to figure it out, but she has figured it out.
So now you can feed her in a jar and she'll actually open it up.
Because they're smart, and I think that we should really, as much as we can, provide her with some sort of entertainment or some sort of activity. Giving her live food is good for her just hunt, mm-hmm. but the extra added activity of trying to get it out of a jar.
Intellectual stimulation. Well, and I mean, there are videos on the internet of octopus doing pretty amazing things, sort of intelligence wise and also like some crazy camouflage wise. I don't know if the ones we have here aren't quite so crazy in their camouflage ability, are they?
They have those sort of chromatophores, those like pigment cells that expand and contract and they turn bright white when they're really afraid. Mm-hmm. And she kind of pulses colors when she's, I'm not really quite understanding. I don't really speak color coding, but she does change color a little bit. But not anything incredibly drastic.
And this is the Pacific octopus.
Giant Pacific octopus. Yeah.
And is it the males that get really big, or do the females also get really big, or do you know?
You know, I don't know much about the sexual dimorphism of giant Pacific octopus.
Yeah, I've just heard that there are some really big ones, but I wasn't mm-hmm. sure if that was like any of them could get really big.
Species in general is just a very large species. Mm-hmm. They're also in the area, these pink octopus or red mm-hmm. octopus.
Oh, okay.
And they're much smaller.
Oh, all right.
And maybe about 3 pounds.
And so this octopus will at some point, I guess it won't have a mate, so...
No.
It will lay eggs?
Maybe it'll live forever, since it won't be able to mate.
But how sad. But so that's that octopus has been there. You've had it since it was little tiny.
Yeah,
and it's
it was about the size of my palm.
A couple years, and you've been raising it, and so you also have some other exciting news of babies.
Oh my gosh, huge news just today! Yeah. I was very very excited, and we had a skate egg brought in to us. We actually had two skate eggs. There was a great skate egg. I tried to identify the egg casing. It's kind of difficult. Mm-hmm. But the great skate egg is pretty characteristically different than some of the other little mermaid purse-like eggs. Mm-hmm. The great skate egg is kind of really fat and has some really interesting grooves on it. But a great skate egg and a long-nose skate egg case, which is just more of your like mermaid's purse, but really, mm-hmm. really thick. And those were brought in by a cucumber diver, and he brought in a couple of other really fun things, like some crabs and things that he'd found. But I didn't know anything about skates, and it's kind of the way it is, honestly. If it's not in the aquarium, I don't know a ton about it.
Yeah.
I really like to get into what's in the aquarium, and I like to get new creatures because I learn more about them. And so that was awesome, and I wrote it into our permit for the next year, hoping that the eggs would hatch and we'd have some skates. And the great skate egg didn't end up hatching. It was actually eaten by a crab. Unfortunate correlation between the crab and the the skate, so do not place your great skate eggs in with any sort of crabs. And then
I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah, exactly. And then the long nose skate hatched this morning. So that was huge. And I ran around the Science Center screaming, it hatched. And it just is adorable. And we're going to have a skate now at the Science Center. So it took a year, though. It came into us last October. And from before that, I don't know how long it had been since. I don't know if you can actually find out online. I looked it up when it came in, and I remember reading that it was supposed to hatch in March. That, or if it was late in March. But I just had kind of given up on it, but yeah, I kept it in a container just floating around in our free flow system, and just checked it this morning, and there was a little skate in there.
So 12 months later, I wouldn't have guessed that they would take that long, but it sounds like that you didn't expect it to take that long.
Right. No, not at all. I'd expected maybe in March or April.
And so this was the long nose skate that was the one, and then the other one was like the big skate?
The grape skate.
Oh, okay. Yeah, interesting. So I don't actually know much about skates, except for that we caught one once when I was a kid. Just halibut fishing and people bring them up that way. But
they kind of hang out in deeper.
Deeper water. I think what they had in the Fishes of Alaska book is that that the longnose skate is usually between 55 and 350 meters, which seems like that's fairly deep. I mean,
really
what's the deepest that you dive to at?
I don't really like going that deep because at like 60. Well, can't go that deep.
Yeah.
That's in meters,
that
right?
That was meters,
oh,
right?
Oh, my gosh,
So that's like
160 feet and below is like not really... I don't really need to.
Yeah. I guess it's starting to get dark down there, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know how... I mean, of course, it depends
visibility
on the time of year.
Depending on the time of year. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's interesting. So these skate cases, and people find these, I guess, mostly where I've heard of people talking about skates is in the context of running into the skate cases.
Yeah.
On the beach or something. And,
yeah,
so you know, where
people
the birds
call them the mermaid purse or...
Yeah, just
I guess.
Little kind of pouch. Pouches kind of thing, and birds will eat them or whatever. And mm-hmm. I don't know how they get up there. I mean,
I assume they must not have made it at that point. Yeah. Like they're probably not viable.
Right. Yeah. And I just, but
from the bottom
right,
to there,
how do they get from 180 feet down
just
up
the
to
cycling
the
cycling of the oceans? That's a great question.
Yeah. I didn't really know. I mean, I heard about that. And I'm like, maybe they lay them on the shore for some reason, but that doesn't really make sense either, I suppose. I mean, some fish move up and they move to shallow water to spawn, or I've heard black cod, you know, a very deep species as adults, so be in shallow water as juveniles, and so there's a lot of stuff like that goes on. But skates, I didn't know. So it's exciting. You're gonna try and keep the skate fed.
Yes. Yeah. They apparently eat small crustaceans. So
more sea monkeys.
Yeah. Yes. Sea monkeys and worms and things similar to what the grunt sculpin eats. So that's kind of great.
So they're mouths on the bottom of the, so they're a flat kind of critter. And I guess I don't really know. What do they just like slurp stuff up from the bottom? Or?
Yeah. They kind of like pounce on it and they just kind of pin it to the bottom and eat it.
And just eat it.
Yeah. And I read that some eat small fishes and like mollusks and things as well, but
I guess I've the things that you think about when it was like, what are the logistics of skate feeding behavior? They don't have arms. They don't. Like fish in general, mostly I think of them chasing it down and just grabbing it. Mm-hmm. But when your mouth is flat on the bottom, I don't know.
It's a funny adaptation for sure.
But I guess, I mean, if you're on the bottom all the time and you just like, that's where your food is and you just pick it up off the bottom. Maybe that makes sense then.
And apparently these sort of long nose skates, they kind of hide out in muddier, flat areas and they kind of just watch because their eyes do kind of stick up a little bit out of the mud and wait until, I guess, something that comes along that they can pounce on.
Hmm. So they'll actually kind of bury a little bit in the mud and just be like, creepy eyes sticking out.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And I went down to check on the skate again, probably like 30 minutes later, because I was just so excited about it. And had noticed it had buried itself in some sediment at the bottom of the tank. And I like didn't see it for a second. I freaked out. But it's doing its natural thing.
So do you have to like have a special aquarium for that, or is it going to be able to go in with the other things?
So that's a great question. Another one of those. What do we do? What can't be put with it? What can be put with it? What eats baby skates? And I don't want to mess that one up. So I'm doing a lot of research on it. It's still kind of, I'm going to keep it in a holding tank for now.
For now.
Yeah. But I really, really want to get it out so people can see it because it's really cute.
Yeah. So in your big tank, like out front, is that mostly, like, that's where all your bigger fish and stuff are?
Yeah. So and, probably not in there in the Wolfiel. And maybe moving one of the crabs, though. We have our box crab, which is really cool. Puget Sound king crab, and really colorful. Mm-hmm. And it has its own tank, but it could probably move in there. And we could do something like a mud flat area. There's some really neat other types of worms and things that I'd like to include that I've been seeing a lot diving around here, and I don't actually know the names of them, but they kind of look like sea anemones, and they come right out of the mud with these really filamentous tentacles and grab and filter grab things.
So are
like
they
big tube worms for the mud flats
related to the tube worms, and maybe polychaetes of some sort? And
they're probably polychaetes,
and polychaetes are, as I understand it anyway, notoriously difficult to identify in many cases. So
Unless they're the huge ones that I also have some weird visceral sense of, like, ugh.
Yeah.
But I mean, they're really important, and they're, although they're really creepy to look at, like their mouth parts and things under the microscopes, I just try not to think about that and think of their important place in the environment, which there is one.
Well, and that's where, I mean, there's a bunch of different kinds of them, I guess, and there are some that are very distinctive. When Aaron Baldwin was up here this summer, and I was able to go down to the beach with him a couple of times, and, you know, we found a couple of polychaetes that he's like, well, we know what this one is because of this, but we don't know what this one is. It's just in this group, you know?
Yeah. I think same like with scale worms and things.
That, yeah.
Like these commensal worms that you might find on a starfish. So if you ever turn over a starfish or even sea cucumbers and things, they're often you'll find a scale worm, and that can surprise some people, but they just kind of eat the stuff between the tube feed of the starfish, and they're all over in the aquarium too. And they kind of have, I didn't necessarily put them there. They might've come in with the critters or have floated through our system and kind of grown up there, but it doesn't seem to hurt the starfish, and they seem to get something out of it, sort of commensal relationship with these, I guess, commensal scale worms. So there you go.
Wow. So are they still there without the starfish, or, I mean, they aren't there.
Yeah. I think they do need the starfish. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I guess, from a commensal scale worm, perspective, the sea star wasting is even more frightening.
Oh no. I mean, they also can help out with sea cucumber tube feet cleaning, but that would cut back on the amount of tube feet to clean.
Like, so I guess this is like you're wrapping up a little over a year now as the aquarium manager. So, and I think I had you on last year around this time.
Mm-hmm,
and we're like,
after my first summer.
We'll see what happens after in the winter. So I should ask you that question.
Oh, yeah.
Did you discover, so you did discover that the isopod or the beach hoppers,
they kind of go away.
They go away. But
almost.
Do the food needs of the critters in your aquarium change a lot during the winter?
A little. A little bit, but not too much. It's interesting. The rockfish actually eat a lot more in the winter, which I thought would kind of be the opposite. And the wolf eel eats a lot more in the winter. That's kind of, in terms of feeding, that's the biggest change that I've seen. But I don't know why.
Well, it's interesting to know. Well, thanks for coming in and sharing some stories about your experiences out there. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Sitka Nature Show with your host, Matt, and a conversation I recorded with Taylor White, the manager of the Sitka Sound Science Center Aquarium, about some of her activities over the last season and going back to last year when she was last guest on the show. So I want to thank her again for coming in, and also thank you for joining me this week on the show. I'll be back in a couple more weeks, heading deeper into the dark season of the year. And as always, please feel free to share your observations. I'd love to hear about what you're seeing. If you have any questions or just want to share, send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page. You could leave comments there and find links to recordings of past shows, or go on sitkanature.org/raven and find the full list of recordings there. So thanks again for joining me this week. This has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW Sitka.